And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to Rates and Barrels. It is our 2023 third base preview as we roll through our position preview series. And well, compared to our last position preview where we looked at first base, this could be a problematic position. There are more ways to screw it up at third base, you know, because as we will discuss, it falls off in a big way. So you need to have a good plan in place if you want to get top-end production or even steady production from the third base spot on your roster this season. The deeper the league, the bigger the problem at hand. So we begin, as we do with all these position previews, looking at the very top of the board. And same as at first base, I do think you could say tier one goes a little beyond the first rounders. It includes the early second rounders as well. So you've got Jose Ramirez, who's pretty much a consensus top five pick right now. Bobby Witt Jr., who does have shortstop eligibility as well. Manny Machado, kind of as the first round group. Machado, a bit like Freddie Freeman, where sometimes you see him end up in the early part of round two. And then you've got this toss-up right around pick 20 with Rafael Devers and Austin Riley. So there are top-end options at the position. Ramirez, I guess the simple question is, are you able to find any reason to pass on him in the top five? Like, you might just like someone else better, but are we at the point where you're seeing any warts in the profile for Jose Ramirez?
No, I think that some of the possible warts that you might see with him too are going to be affected by the rules changes. He's a massive pull guy, and he puts a ton of balls in play. So if you have looked at his line before and been like, is he going to hit 260 this year? You know, he kind of does that every other year. I just don't think this is going to be the year he hits 260. You know what I mean? Like the year that they changed the shift rules on a guy who pulls the ball over 50% of the time a lot. You know, no, I don't think this is the year. So that's the only weakness, I think, in his profile, other than just the massive disconnect between how he looks and how good of a player he is. Like I'm just always like, that dude's a real athlete. He's like a little mini David Ortiz. I don't know.
It's working for him though. Yeah, still stealing bases, still getting to that power, still keeping the K rate low, still drawing walks. And I think I look at the projections for average. We've got steamer, ATC, and the bat, and the range is 261 to 269. I'd be tempted to take the over even on the higher end outcome of that range. I think there's a good chance he ends up being more of a 280, 290 guy again with those rules changes. And even as he continues to age, I mean, the new stolen base rule should keep that total in the high teens, low 20s for another year or two. I mean, there's just a lot to like in this profile. The only little wart that I saw is that we did see Jose Ramirez swinging at more pitches outside the zone than we've ever seen before in 2022. That's pretty much it. We've seen him do this with low barrel rates before, so I don't look at the 6.6% barrel rate and worry about that. I think you're going to see a lower barrel rate for a guy that strikes out as infrequently as Ramirez does. This is just what a steady first rounder looks like as he ages.
Yeah, I'm trying to do some spreadsheet work on the fly here. Oh, why is that not working?
I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing at how the sausage is made, because I think people have this idea that we're firing on all cylinders all the time, and we're definitely not.
Okay, well, I was trying to pull up his pulled line drives, but that's not going to happen right now, I guess, for spreadsheet reasons. No, I'm into that. You did this cool thing where you have a visual representation of dollar values versus ADP, so you can kind of get a sense of the shape of this. And I see very clearly six third basemen that are worth more than $20. And then you've got another I don't know, 10 to 12 that are worth more than zero.
That's so discouraging.
Like, there's really, in between 10 and 20 bucks, there's some guys, but they don't always line up with ADP. And some of them are just, I don't believe, right? Like, Yandy Diaz has like a $13 projection. I'm sorry. I just don't believe it. So if you take away the ones you don't believe, there's like three guys who have a projection between 10 and 20 bucks. It's like feast or famine, baby. Get it early or get it late.
Find someone that you think is going to play more than the projections think is going to play. Find someone who's young, who's going to take a massive step forward. Sure, those are ways to come out of this with a little bit of extra value. But I think this is a position that you want to prioritize early. If you do have an early mid-first round position, the more I think about Bobby Witt Jr., the more I think if you draft him, you're probably going to go ahead and just use him as a third baseman because of the way this position comes together. I mean, you have the option to use him at short, of course, but I think shortstop is so deep, as we'll talk about in a future episode, you might as well lean into that depth and take advantage of getting a lot of stolen bases from the third base spot on your roster where, yeah, Ramirez runs, Witt runs, but a lot of guys don't offer that. Brian Hayes, we'll talk about later, is one of the few late third basemen that could give you a meaningful contribution in that category as well. So I think as I look at Witt, I've talked a lot about some of the flaws and concerns I see. I'm more likely to have him in a non-snake draft situation. That's the way I look at him right now. It's fine. He's a mid-first rounder. There's just guys that go in the late part of the round, even the early part of round two, who I trust more because of their floors.
Yeah, it's the one debate that I think is kind of interesting in this group of top players, because I do like all of them, and I think they're all fine second rounders in the sort of Machado, Devers, Riley, Arenado group. I actually think that they're all fine second rounders. I know Arenado's ADP is a little bit different than the other ones. I've seen a lot of like Riley should go over Devers because of the quality of the rest of the team. And I have some sympathy for that, except that that home park for Devers is a batting average creator. And that's going to turn outs into hits, and that's going to help, you know, even a mediocre lineup produce 100 RBI, I think, for Devers. That said, he only had 88 last year. I don't know why.
I think those are legit concerns. I mean, I think
I like Devers a little better as a hitter than Devers. I mean, I like Devers a little better as a hitter, just a pure hitter than Riley, right?
Yeah, it's the K percentage difference. I mean, this is a trust your gut. What do you believe in? You know, skills wise, projections wise, there's not much that separates them. They're almost identical according to the Bat X. One home run extra on Riley's total. I think two more RBIs on the Devers side. Not sure I believe in that. Wobos are the same. Riley showed better power last year, had a better barrel rate, had a better max EV last year. They both draw walks at about an 8% rate. They're both great players. I think because of the age and the expectations when they were prospects, I think Devers, in the minds of a lot of people, still has one more level he can reach, whereas Riley has maxed out, maybe even is an overachiever relative to some of the expectations people had for him as a prospect. I don't know how accurate or true that is. I just think it's one of those weird little things that might lead people to want Devers more than Riley, given the choice. Do you like them as much as Machado, or more than Machado, by the way, or do you prefer Machado to each of them?
I prefer Machado.
Okay. I figured you might.
I think it's a combination of, like, you know, makes the contact that you want, makes better contact, I think, than both of them, has the batted ball quality, and then there's not really as much. So it's like the best strikeout rate of the three, right? Some of the best plate discipline of the three, and then this second or third or second or best team situation just happens to be a little bit older.
Braves, Padres, in terms of how good the lineup around those guys are. Once Tatis is back, maybe it favors the Padres. Before Tatis is back, maybe a slight edge to the Braves, but they're both elite lineups.
Machado's also going to steal more bases than either of them.
Yep. You'll get a handful of bags from Machado. You probably won't get more than a couple from Devers, and you might not get any from Riley. You might get zeros from Riley and Devers in that category. You're not necessarily drafting them for that, but the bigger issue, really, at this position is what happens after this group? Like, there's really no one in this cluster that I'm going to say, don't draft that guy. I think my only warning with this entire group is I'd rather have someone else where Witt goes. But if you want Witt there, great. He does almost everything, might have a little bit of batting average risk, could still get a lot better. It's the Arenado, Bregman, and then massive fall off. It's like you end up in a spot if your first two players are not a third baseman where you almost have to be willing to jump up Bregman if you don't get Arenado in the third round, because the ADP on Nolan Arenado is just behind most of those late second rounders. It's a little bit like the Matt Olson situation at first base in a lot of ways, where you're like, okay, it's either him or I wait a little while, and then if I do want to get that last good guy, I probably have to take him ahead of ADP because there's literally no one else close to these players.
Yeah, I had that exact same situation happen in a draft and hold that I did. I had Alex Bregman and Gunnar Henderson as the last two third basemen I really wanted to be my starting third baseman. And Gunnar Henderson has, we can talk about it in a second, but it has a large disparity between, as many young players do, between their projection system. So I really felt Alex Bregman was the last safe situation. And I was at pick, I was in my fifth round pick. So, so pick sort of, 60, 66, I think it was. And I knew that I had to wait, all the way, to like 85, for my next pick, and that the ADPs for Bregman and Henderson were under 80, but above 66. You know what I mean? So I had to jump him. And I had to jump him on his ADP maybe 10, 12 picks because I just didn't want... I'd like Gunnar Henderson, but I also didn't want to let it ride and then lose Gunnar Henderson as well. Because if that's the last two and you've got, you know, 18, you know, 20, whatever picks it is before you go again, then yeah, you know, you could lose both of them pretty easily. Everybody else can see the tier coming too, right? So I jumped Bregman to make sure that I got a third baseman in the group. And, you know, I guess the decision that led to me having to jump Bregman was taking Brandon Woodruff in the third, three picks ahead of Nolan Arenado. Because otherwise I wasn't eligible to take any other third baseman unless I really jump Witt over Tucker, but I really like Kyle Tucker. So, you know, I needed a starting pitcher in the third, I felt. And so I didn't get an Arenado. That meant I had to get Bregman later.
What's really strange to me is that for two guys that have been in the league for a long time and have very good track records, is the projection system disagreements on Arenado and Bregman. Depending on which one you look at, there's like a strong preference for one over the other. And I think what we're going to see now that there are more systems out there, we're going to see Bregman continue to creep up closer to where Arenado goes. I think that's going to look more like a toss-up in March than it does in January, and then it's looked
it's
throughout the winter.
It's weird to me that the Bat X has Bregman as worth like almost $4 more than Nolan Arenado. I think it has to do with this, is that there was a bit of a spike in the barrel rate for Nolan Arenado last year, and that, you know, I know that... I've had this discussion with Derek Hardy before, which is that no matter what your barrel rate says you deserved last year, you have to regress the barrel rate to their career norms. And so last year he had an 8.2% barrel rate, but the 3 years before that he had a sub 7% barrel rate. So what, you know, the bat is going to do is regress that barrel rate and regress the power. However, there is the subjective understanding that Nolan Arenado has spent the last two seasons at Driveline increasing his bat speed, and that his bat speed has actually increased, and that his max EV has increased the last two seasons, and his barrel rate has increased the last two seasons, and then he spent this season, this offseason again at Driveline working on the same things. So we also know that he pulled more fly balls than he ever had in his career in St. Louis, because that was a big Jeff Albert thing. That guy's now with the Mets. That'll be an interesting thing to see, is if the Mets all start pulling fly balls. But Arenado is doing the things that should produce this power and has really, you know, I think, done the studying. And I have a bias towards that. So I'm going to actually, as much as I like the bat projections, take the steamer projections for Nolan Arenado this year based on just the sort of surrounding narrative, I guess.
Yeah, it feels like he's been around forever, but I think when you know more about how he made those adjustments, how he's increased the bat speed, it gives you a reason to believe that going back to previous barrel rates is not necessarily the most likely outcome in this case, even though in general player pool, that's the right approach. Without that added information, that's the safer sort of assumption to make. I am finding that the only flaw with the Arenado and Bregman grouping is that if you're drafting one of these two, you're passing on some of the really nice sources of stolen bases at other positions. So you just have to have a good plan in place for finding some steals a little bit later on. And we're talking about, you know, round 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. If you've got a handful of guys that you really like that go in that range, they're going to run enough, no problem at all. But just be mindful of...
I ended up taking Tim Anderson because I took Bregman as well.
Because you're passing on like Randy Arozarena, potentially. You're passing on Luis Robert. You're passing on Cedric Mullins. Like, those guys are all solid stolen base sources, right? So just know that there's going to be a cost later for taking one of these guys as early as they go.
Strangely, in my draft, the stolen base, like just in terms of one pick to the next, the stolen bases that I gave up were Tommy Edman and Corbin Carroll. Which I was actually okay with. But taking Tim Anderson, because I felt I'm falling behind a little bit in steals, I did take him over Willy Adames, who I really liked this year. So there was a choice there of, hey, here's an oft-injured guy who steals bases, but might be, if he has a good, you know, season, he's projected to be equal value to Willy Adames. But Willy Adames has been more healthy and is like a 30-homer hitting shortstop. You know, I did have to sacrifice. You're right. There are sacrifices you make. And it never feels good to jump bid a guy to get the last of a tier. You feel desperate. You feel like you've done something wrong. I think by projection values, especially by the bat, I did okay. I got, the bat says Bregman is worth almost $20, $19. And I got him as my fifth pick. That's fine. You know? But it meant I didn't get Corey Seager. It meant I didn't get Willy Adames later. It meant a whole bunch of other things. And it meant that I did jump him versus ADP. So it's something to think about.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So you mentioned Gunnar Henderson just a few moments ago and that you were thinking about him as that fallback option, but then concerned if someone else swooped in that you'd miss out. So it sounds like you've got a pretty lofty expectation for him with a full run of playing time over the 2023 season in Baltimore. Of course, a late season debut where he showed us some pretty impressive underlying skills, 9.8% barrel rate, nice high walk rate. K rate wasn't that bad either at 25.8%. It was only 34 games, but a lot to like in that profile. You go back to the minor leagues last year between AA and AAA. Gunnar Henderson was 22 of 25 as a base stealer. So very efficient. You think about a guy that should get on base a lot, who runs well with the new rules. He can make value that way, or he could just get to that power right away because we saw 19 homers at those two minor league stops as well. And we saw 4 in the big leagues during his brief time in Baltimore late in the year.
Yeah, I understand the bat's sort of outlook on this and that, you know, it's not a much sample. He didn't give us much sample last year. He's still a young player. A lot of young players fail. I wonder if it could be tweaked to be a little bit more aggressive, because 132 playing appearances is not nothing. He hit a ball 111 last year. He did have a 10% barrel rate. You know, we got information about how often he chases balls outside of the zone, not very much. How his walk rate would look, how his contact rate, 10% swing strike rate, that's pretty good. So I see all the process things, and I will take the over on the bat projection of 244, 16 homers, and 8 stolen bases any day. I think I might even take the over on the steamer projection. I'm pretty excited about this guy. I would have liked to have gotten him. And it turns out that I could have gotten him on the way back if I'd let it ride. So maybe my conservatism hurt me a little bit, but I think Gunnar Henderson is absolutely a firewall at the position. I know he's projected by the bat for $8 value. I would put him ahead of Ryan McMahon and Matt Chapman into the sort of $16 to $18 territory. And he's either the beginning of the next tier or the end of the first tier, depending on how much risk you can handle with young players.
So I like him long term, and I think it's exactly the same to me as the problem we faced last year for Bobby Witt Jr.'s rookie season. Where he goes in terms of ADP, what he did at the highest level in the minor leagues, the ways it can go right. I think you see maybe a little more patience from Henderson, but not so much that you're looking at a radically different but player.
Also a lower draft price than Witt.
Slightly right now in January, but...
You think the helium is going to get to him?
I think he's going to push up another...
And actually, Bobby Witt was like a fifth rounder last year, huh? He's sixth right now in my draft, he was.
The most aggressive, most competitive leagues that happen in March, I think you're going to see Gunnar Henderson tick up a little bit. Everyone wants to be right about players like this, and it worked if you went after Witt. I didn't. I still had a pretty good year anyway, so you don't have to get these players, the FOMO players. I think the consideration that makes Henderson different is that as a third base eligible player this year where third base nosedives really hard, there's a different problem at hand. Witt was shortstop eligible last year at a position that was really deep. Yeah. So you weren't playing the same game of chicken at the position by passing on Witt. You were getting established guys that could do something similar, albeit in many cases with less speed. So I do think that's the one caveat that might lead Henderson to a team or two of mine, but I don't think I'm going to have him everywhere, even though I like the profile long-term, even though the team seems to be headed in the right direction.
Here's some evidence. Maybe a auction situation where you can put exactly the dollar amount you want on him. You'll be more likely to end up with him.
Yep.
The evidence that he is the end of a tier in my draft, there were 35 picks between Gunnar Henderson and the next third baseman.
Oof.
So yeah. We had two full rounds of nothing before Max Muncy and Matt Chapman went in two. And after Max Muncy and Matt Chapman, there was another 35 picks, and we still haven't signed a third baseman. So if you want evidence of the death of a position, that's it. Two picks in 65, two third basemen in 65 picks. And I would argue that maybe Muncy and Chapman were jumped a little bit. It's a draft and hold situation. So Muncy is a second baseman that plays a third. So there's a little bit of added value there. But as we speak, since this won't go up right away, I can admit that I'm considering taking Ke'Bryan Hayes in this round just because third base sucks so much, and I don't really want to take my second baseman, my second third baseman much later.
Yeah, so you're already talking about players that by dollar value are really tier three players.
Yeah, this is how bad it gets that quick. Ke'Bryan Hayes is a $9 player by the bat.
Where was tier two? Well, if tier two is a thing at third base, Bregman's kind of like the only guy. Henderson, you could argue into it. And if you want to pull Arenado down, however you want to cluster it, they're spread out right now.
I'm saying Bregman's the end of the first and Gunner is the middle. And if there's a middle, it's Gunner, Chapman.
Yeah, you don't have to do that. We could just say tier two barely exists. And now we're into tier three. I think that's that's the appropriate way to label it.
Ryan McMahon has a double-digit projection, I guess I believe in.
I hate this position. I really do.
It's really bad.
Max Muncy is the ninth third base eligible player off the board at like pick 125 by January ADP. I'm worried about Muncy because he never had surgery on the elbow.
Yeah,
it's nice. He still has the eligibility at second and third, so you can move him around a little bit. Second's pretty crappy, too, as we'll talk about in a future episode.
The rules changes should be good for him.
Should be good for him. I just think there's a legitimate major health concern, so I'm worried about him. Jose Miranda is fine, but I don't really like him projection? In that range. No, it's okay.
The bat's projection is not as... The bat says he's tier three or four.
I think he's inflated coming off of last season, and I also... I think the players at other positions around pick 140 where Miranda goes are much, much better. So I'm not doing that. Eugenio Suarez is fine. He's a low average, big power masher, no real threats to his playing time. That's okay. My fear is that Suarez is going to creep up the board. Suarez is going to close the gap on Muncy. So you're going to have to pay up another round or two to get to him.
And if you're buying Suarez and Muncy, man, I just see that's where I kind of like Ke'Bryan Hayes here. Is like with Muncy and Suarez, I see old guys, you know? And then and Anthony Rendon, like old and injured. I'm just like, there's injury, there's age. Justin Turner's in this tier. Like, I don't want any part of that tier, really. And I moved Alec Bohm down into that tier and Yandy Diaz, despite their double-digit projections, because I don't believe their double-digit projections. So now you've got five guys that go in a row that I don't want any part of. I mean, I could get argued into Muncy if the cost gets really low, but Muncy, Bohm, Suarez, Diaz, Rendon is a minefield. I would say that three out of those five are going to be bad this year. That's not a good percentage. That's not where I want to live. So I'm considering taking Hayes to stay out of that group. I think I've actually convinced myself to that right there on air.
good pep talk for yourself. In an effort to help everyone listening, I think the thing about Ke'Bryan Hayes, that there's two things about him that make him a little safer than a lot of this group. He doesn't have the terrible injury history that some of the older players have. And defensively, as we've said many times before, he is so good at third base, he plays every day.
Most defensive war in baseball last year, I think.
If you were to draft him around pick 150 where he goes, and he repeated what he did in 2022, you'd be disappointed for sure, right? But you got 20 steals. Counting stats were light, 55 runs, 41 RBIs. Team should be a little better this year, so those numbers would probably go up even if he repeated the line. Maybe you don't get any more power, but most likely you've drafted power early anyway. And most likely, if you're even thinking about Hayes, you're looking for a little bit of speed, which he provides. I think he could be a good source of batting average. That's possible. K rate's not out of control bad. So even if he doesn't hit the ball a lot harder and get to more power, I don't think he's necessarily going to be a 244 hitter in the long run.
He could be good in that category. Average, yeah.
Projections got him at 256. I could live with that. So there's a few ways he could just get better. Playing just time is really
low
safe.
Low pull percentage, man. Like, can he get to his pull power? If he could get to his pull power, everything would change.
I think the guy that I actually like, who goes outside the top 200, I think he belongs inside this cluster, is Ryan McMahon. I think we saw a few signs of growth from him last year. Got the 20 homers, still has a strikeout problem, right? You're still giving up something in average, but you're giving up something in average with Muncy. You're giving up something in average with Chapman.
And he's going to have a better BABIP because of the home park.
Yeah, and I think, again, you're sidestepping some of the terrible injury concerns that are sprinkled in to this group. So I think McMahon is really underpriced, and I guess the only thing you have to worry about is jumping him up too high just because you like him more than some of the guys that go earlier. Because if you miss, if you whiff on him and all those other backup low average power mashers, if they all disappear, then you're in the dregs. Like, you're in a horrible, horrible spot. I do like Anthony Rendon. I've said it for months. I think it's reasonable, even with his terrible recent injury history.
It's also one of the cheapest of that group, right? Of that old group.
He's in the McMahon cluster price-wise right now. And I think that could go up if he's healthy in the spring and everything looks good. You know, he'll go from pick 250 to pick 175 or 200. But that's not bad. You're talking about a toss-up of Anthony Rendon versus Alec Bohm. I can't tell you what Alec Bohm does exceptionally well. Hit tool's pretty good, so average is okay. But I don't know. At least with Anthony Rendon, I think he's got that sort of core ability with a little extra power and plenty of run production. If the Angels stay reasonably healthy Anthony Rendon's bounce back could be a pretty profitable one for us.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, our injury projections are tough, and it's where we're most human and we have to make our biggest guesses. Certainly hasn't looked good the last two seasons, but you can also argue that he's had a full off season to, you know, get past these. He's had the surgeries and, you know, maybe this is the year that he's finally healthy.
Yeah. I think the fact that he was back at the very end of the year does mean something, because he wasn't rehabbing all winter. He was preparing all winter.
Yeah.
There's a pretty big difference.
It's a huge, that's a huge deal when we talk about pitchers, right? Mm-hmm. We're always much more likely to take someone coming off of TJ if he pitched a little, you know, cause he made it, back. He made it to game shape at some point. So yeah, it's interesting to think about hitters that way too.
Yeah, I think it matters. You're not limited in what you're able to do and going through your offseason progression. I think of those older, low-average power guys, Muncy, Suarez, Chapman, I like Chapman the most. Still a good defender, got past that bad injury. Jays lineup, really good. Like Muncy, you could see the Dodgers, if a bunch of random stuff is happening, maybe they take a little bit of playing time away. I don't think Chapman loses playing time. Matt Chapman is still a max PT player, and I like that.
They seem to have made a concerted effort to improve their defense this year. I mean, if you think about the difference between moving George Springer off of center and going from Teoscar Hernandez to Dalton Varsho, and putting Kiermaier in center, these all sort of things seem to line up to improving the defense, you know, along with this weird outfield wall change. So, I think Chapman is one of those places where they're going to have to play, because they're going to do some mixing and matching in the outfield and at second. And like we often say, is like, you know, there, if you do some mixing and matching in certain places, you have to have certain places where there's a guy who posts almost every day.
Yep. So I think that's exactly what Chapman brings as part of that infield in Toronto. Now,
I just don't think he's going to like hit for a better batting average going forward. Or
But I think that's pretty much the same thing I'd say about Suarez too. It's like, this is just sort of what you get, but it's fine. It works. They need him. He's important to their lineup right now.
Very similar to Suarez, actually. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's why they get clustered together. So I think they're sort of your safest parachute options. If you need power, I think Brian Hayes works if you need the speed. And I think the average comes out a little better with Hayes. Failing that, I think Ryan McMahon, very underrated, should be more in this group, even with some of the flaws that he has.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them. You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
What are your other contingencies, though? Like, if you're looking for depth, who do you like for depth at this position? You get outside the top 200 overall at third base, and I'm just curious, what stands out to you in this range?
I don't like it. I don't like it at all. I don't like it. I like Luis Urias, and we had a conversation about that. I think that Milwaukee depth chart is actually something that players of deep leagues need to kind of peruse and make some decisions about, because we had a slightly difference of opinion, I think, when we talked about it off air, where I thought Brian Anderson is a guy who's going to play every day and the rest are going to be mix and match. You I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you thought maybe Luis Urias was the guy who's going to play every day and everything else would be mix and match. We might both be right and the mixing and matching goes on around them. because the types of players we're talking about that are, you know, going around them are untested. You know, even Tyrone Taylor, you know, might be a small side platoon guy. Garrett Mitchell in center is not proven in any sort of way. And then Bryce Turang coming up in the minor leagues, you know, he could stay in the minor leagues, you know, with the depth they have now. So I kind of think Luis Urias plays second, Brian Anderson plays third, and the rest is determined by how well Tyrone Taylor, Garrett Mitchell, and Bryce Turang play.
Right, because you can, if you need to, you could move Brian Anderson to a corner outfield spot. And that would probably come at the expense of Tyrone Taylor.
If Turang's amazing. Yeah. If
he, right. Because then Turang plays second and Urias slides back over to third.
But then again, I was looking at Turang's line and he was below average at almost every stop in the minor leagues until he was just 108 WRC plus as an older AAA guy. Like, I don't know if I believe in Bryce Turang.
I think there's a good chance he's more of a super utility guy than an everyday player on a playoff caliber team.
And that might be true of Tyrone Taylor, too. Of the three young guys, am I wrong to like Garrett Mitchell the best? I mean, most prospect pedigree, can play center the best, probably in the most premium defensive position. Power and speed, I think. I don't know. Not the power hasn't always been there.
Yeah, I think what I like to use when you have a depth, there's plenty of depth charts that are built this way now. You have to look at how everyone projects against each other. How important is this player's bat to this team? Luis Urias is projected to be the fifth best hitter for the Brewers. So Rowdy, Winker, Yelich, and Adames are better, right? Winker coming off two surgeries, I like him, but if Winker's hurt, that makes Urias even more important to how they score runs. You get behind that, it's like, okay, William Contreras, yep, he's the starting catcher. He's their sixth best offensive player. Keston Hira, it only works in a bench role. Tyrone Taylor, no guarantee he's an everyday guy. They've got a bunch of other outfielders. Sal Frelick could come up and play.
If you use Steamer instead of the bat, Brian Anderson would be in this mix. Steamer likes him to be probably the sixth or seventh best hitter on the Brewers.
Right, so that kind of makes him a priority to play. And then Turang comes out pretty low in the projections, probably because of that lack of power in the minor leagues. And league-adjusted offensive performances are really important to consider. I think that number, like that performance from Turang, points more toward a part-time player, at least in the short term. So I think Luis Urias ends up being someone that I really like after pick 200. I just like the versatility, too. Second, third, sure. It's nice to have at least one player on your roster that can go corner middle, and having a third spot being second, third, and short, I think that's really, really nice to have. Justin Turner, I mean, the way the Red Sox are built, the projections are always pretty steady.
Also,
do you believe he can do it for one more year?
DH now, though.
Yeah, he's a DH.
People aren't as good as DH as they're not as good as they normally are at DH.
Well, I wonder how much they're gonna. Are they gonna DH Turner half the time, three quarters of the time? Devers is gonna get some days off his legs, I would imagine.
And then there's the whole Tristan Casas at first question.
Yeah, so I think there's. There's not necessarily like a 150 games at DH for Justin Turner. But do you believe in the bat still being good enough to help as a corner infield filler?
I do think so. It just strikes me as an AL only situation where, you know, if I'm taking Justin Turner, like what am I taking Justin Turner to do? Like as the eight, like he's like maybe the 16th best third baseman. 18th best third baseman. Like, I don't want to be my starting third baseman.
I think you're taking him as a corner.
But then there's so many more first basemen that are going to be valued higher. So I don't even think you really want him as a corner. Now you're taking him as a bench third baseman. No, I think AL only third baseman. Draft and hold second third baseman.
Do you feel the same way about Yoan Moncada?
The only difference for me is the age is key. Like, I know the projections are very close to each other, but Moncada's 27, and we were talking about a guy who had long COVID and has had some real injury problems. And, you know, another year away from COVID could actually be a big deal for him. And we know that he has, you know, he's had better seasons in the past. I could see him. If there's a playing time, like between the two of them, I think Moncada's going to have more playing time. upside between the two of them, Makata's going to have the upside. So I'm taking Makata over Turner.
Yeah, I think I would probably do that too. I think Makata ends up being a little overlooked right now. He's going around pick 350 in January drafts. Like that's probably an overcorrection. Yandy Diaz versus Yoan Moncada. I at least have seen more in-game power from Moncada, so I can buy into that. I know there's batting average downside on Moncada, whereas Diaz is actually an asset in the category, like a late source of plus batting average, which is hard to get. But I think Moncada, people have soured on him a little bit too much based on, you know, some of the things he's shown us earlier in his career, especially, and the fact that he is not that old at this time. He's still 28 in May. It's not dust.
Yeah, he could actually have a peak season. I mean, that's not that crazy. So the projections have him above average. The team needs him to play well. He's 27, another year removed. I know that he's got flaws, but I like him better than Turner. And then, you know, once you get past that group and you're talking more about these sort of late possibilities, I like the Luis Urias, and then even later Brian Anderson. Those two I brought up. Josh Jung, I think, is one of the very few, maybe the only, kind of young third baseman that I think will play every day, allow him to struggle, that has upside as presented by his 10% barrel rate and his awesome minor league stats, other than his last AAA spot where he was just barely above league average. That is coming off of injury. So I think another year removed from that massive injury that he had, I could see him really coming into his own and showing power, patience, not necessarily contact, not necessarily batting average, but maybe even a little speed. So he's a guy that you could take late if you are desperate for upside. Then there's some guys I've mentioned before in other casts, such as Isak Paredes and Spencer Steer, as guys who I think will play a lot, who do have some upside. Especially for Paredes, like I think Paredes deserves, I don't know where we should highlight him because he plays everywhere. But this seems to be a position of the biggest need, maybe even more than second base. So Isak Paredes gets my highlight right now. If you took everything but BABIP off of the board, you would think this guy was hitting 300. He has a 17% K rate with a 6% swing strike rate, a 6% barrel rate, hit the ball 110 last year, has a good eye at the plate, is not a total zero with the speed. He hit 205 because he had a 195 BABIP. Even though his career BABIP is 217, and he hits some fly balls, I don't think he deserves that sort of BABIP. So if you give him a 260 or 270 BABIP, he could hit 250, 260 next year with 20, 25 homers. All that's on the board. He hit 20 homers and 381 plate appearances last year. If you need some late juice at the third base position, I think it's Isak Paredes.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. I mean, the quality of the contact is good enough. A lot of hard hit balls. You're 100% right. That average came out much lower than it should have for a player with those skills. Even if he's a bad runner that hits the ball into the shift and hits too many fly balls, that's not who he is. A 195 BABIP is just abnormal. Just going to be 24 years old in February. And we talked about Kyle Manzardo on the first base preview. I think of the stack of players on their first base depth chart, Paredes is the one who's most convincing to me as a possible everyday guy. He's the guy that could take over, kind of push Harold Ramirez into more of that part-time role. And we could say, they decided to give 450 plus plate appearances to Paredes, and look, they were rewarded with cheap power. So I think that's a really good call. I've liked Paredes for a long time. It's just sort of a bonus that you get him at so many other spots along the way. The prospect landscape of this position is weird. You mentioned Josh Jung. I like him a lot. I think that lineup's getting a lot better. I think the skills we've seen when he's been on the field in the upper levels of the minor leagues around injuries are really steady. So I have no problem taking a shot on him where he's going. I think same as we've said with other positions, you can't take a chance on prospects everywhere in redraft. So if this is where the flaw is going to be, one of these multi-position eligible glue guys becomes even more important to stash away on your roster. Miguel Vargas could play a lot at third base and pick up third base eligibility again, but based on the way the rules work, is only first base eligible. Otherwise, he would stand out.
Played primarily in the minor leagues.
70 plus games at AAA at that spot's the place he played most by far, but the rules are written the way they are, so he's first base only for now. Then there's Jordan Walker, who, because of Nolan Arenado, is not going to play third base when he comes
but
up
might
in
be
St.
eligible
Louis.
At third base.
Eligible at third base in a lot of places. And, okay, I get the question is, on that St. Louis depth chart, where does he break in? Can you come up with the narrative that gives Jordan Walker an everyday role relatively quickly in 2023? And if you can do that, what does he do with it? Does he do enough to become an immediate impact player, even in shallow mixed leagues?
I'm not paying the cost. I'm not paying the freight, because I believe in Nootbaar, O'Neill, and Carlson in the outfield, and I just don't see an everyday role there. Carlson is the weakest, but I don't know that I want to play O'Neill, Nootbaar, or Walker in center. So I think Carlson has held on to that job by actually his defensive chops. In the infield, yes, Brendan Donovan and Nolan Gorman is not a great situation at second, but I don't see Jordan Walker as having the kind of defensive agility to be a good second baseman. DH is a really natural place. He could end up a DH, but I don't think teams bring up young guys like this to be a DH. Juan Yepes is not Jordan Walker. Jordan Walker is like untouchable in trade talks. Juan Yepes is the total guy that you would bring up and put in DH. You know what I mean? Like just an older guy, used to be playing another position, doesn't really have a glove, can rake, you know, at every minor league position. Yeah, just bring him up. But Jordan Walker is not the same as Juan Yepes, I don't think. And so then Juan Yepes was 9% better than league average last year with the bat, and is projected to be 9 to 20% better than league average of the bat this year. So Juan Yepes doesn't seem that ripe for the taking either. So I don't know, man. I think it'll take an injury. And yes, Tyler Neal gets injured a lot, so maybe Jordan Walker is up. But timing that and getting the most value out of that, what kind of an injury is it for Tyler O'Neill? Is it a two-week injury and Jordan Walker comes up for 2 weeks and then goes back down? Congratulations, you just spent all of your fab. Or you nursed a guy on your roster forever for 2 weeks, you know, for a two-week stint. So, and then lastly, and this is more just of a scouting aspect, I found his upper half to be fairly rigid at the fall league, and I tend to focus on the 16% swing strike rate and the 18% swing strike rate at high A, and think that this guy is going to strike out 28 to 30% of the time in the major leagues. So I think it'll be a nice power, but 30% strikeout rate in the major leagues, I don't think means he hits the ground running and takes the job right away.
I'm more in on Jordan Walker.
I don't know. I think I'm in the minority on this.
I think this is the sweet spot where I love to throw a dart on someone that people have as a top 10 prospect, because it's around pick 300 right now. Even if you move him up to pick 200 or 225,
it's not a high cost. You're right.
Let's say he's having a great spring, right? There's going to be helium because there's power and there's speed, and he's young, and he's a tank. He's a big dude. He looks like a big leader.
But he's having
already.
A great spring. Whose job does he take? Yepes's. They just like, we'll rotate him in and out of DH, and O'Neill will play DH.
Yeah, I don't think you have to play Juan Yepes. I think if Jordan Walker's ready, you say, that dude's our future. Juan Yepes is a nice player, but he's just a guy. We play Walker, and then you just rotate your outfielders.
Yeah, you could have Yepes and Walker on the same team.
You could easily do that, I think. And
five, that's your five outfielders and DH.
I think it works. And you could whittle away at the playing time of Dylan Carlson if you don't like what you see. You could let injuries dictate it. I mean, there are ways for this to work. I just think Walker does enough things well. I think maybe the swing and miss concerns that you outlined are not being reflected in the projections right now, but the projections have me pretty optimistic that if he does get that chance, he's going to hold his own. And I think the Cardinals, they could use one more high-impact offensive player in the mix. And I think Walker has a better chance to be that guy than Nolan Gorman in the second base DH mix right now. And I think Walker has a better chance to be that guy than Yepez. I think Yepez has the safer floor, but if you're playing to win, you're playing to be a playoff team that does damage, I think Jordan Walker is part of how you get there.
Yeah.
That's where I'm at. I think it's more like he could force the issue and change the plans with a couple other guys. Because you've seen enough Dylan Carlson. Like, how much more Dylan Carlson do you need to see before you can start to lower his playing time slightly if you have someone else that is clearly ready to do something good?
So outs above average are not, it's not, it's supposed to be equivalent when you look at outs above average for a corner outfielder versus a center fielder. It's supposed to be equivalent. It's supposed to just look at things like, you know, how far did you run to get that catch? How hard was that catch? You know, it's supposed to be agnostic of where you are. However, center fielders are tasked with different, more difficult balls. So they have a higher sample of difficult balls to try and get to, you know? So it's not exactly equivalent, but it is interesting to note that Tyler O'Neill and Lars Nootbaar had the same outs above average as Adolis Garcia last year. So they were above average defenders. Maybe they see, they think in St. Louis that they can run one of those guys out there. Dylan Carlson has to add some bat speed to his equation to even get to the projections that he's being projected for, I think. Last year's line looks great in every way except for the batted ball stuff. It's just not a good max EV, not a good barrel rate. However, I think with the defensive part, he's going to keep that job.
Looking back to see how did they compare, how much more valuable was the double-A performance of Dylan Carlson versus Jordan Walker? Man, Dylan Carlson really has let us down. A 142 WRC plus as a 20-year-old in 2019. He was going to the moon, right? Yeah. I mean, Walker coming up the season he just had, which was fantastic. Also a 20-year-old at double-A. 128 WRC plus. The Carlson season was even better. But this is where the contact quality becomes really important. And I wonder how much different was the quality of contact Dylan Carlson was making. And age to level matters, and Dylan Carlson the can EVs still get a lot are, better. Walker hits the ball a lot harder than Dylan Carlson did, doesn't he?
He does. The EVs are better. There's a recent release from Baseball America where you can see the top prospects, average EVs. It's not the greatest stat point, but it does show you that I think Jordan Walker was averaging 92. It's way better than some of the 85s you've got on there. Like Sal Frelick, I think, had like an 85, you know?
Oh, but thanks for making me feel good and then make me feel terrible in the same sentence. Wonderful. Sweet.
But any case, I've also seen some stuff from Prospects Live where they had, I think, max EV, and he was in the top 10th percentile of the minor leagues and max EV too. So he hits the ball harder, and it is one of the missing things that we don't have on the outside when we're trying to appreciate how good prospects are. That's why you've got to take a look at scouting grades for raw power and game power in particular. Carlson was 45-55 and raw power 50-55. And Walker, that's at Fangraphs, but they're helpful tool-by-tool grades. Jordan Walker has 70/80 raw power. So that's a huge difference.
Aha. Uh-huh. See? I'm talking you into Jordan Walker. No, I don't know if I'm actually doing that. But I love him where he's going right now. Think about what could go right, because at that price, if it doesn't go right away, you can move on, you know, take a chance on him once he gets the call later on in the season.
You know, we were talking about liking Matt Mervis, you know, as a prospect, if you needed it at a position of need. There's very few of those for third base. So, you know, if you find yourself, you know, late in your draft and hold, and your second third baseman ended up being Jose Miranda or Brian Anderson, then you are in some trouble and you might need some upside of the position, and there's very few places to get it. You know, I might go with Isak Paredes because he's going to play, and he's going to play from the beginning of the season, and he's got maybe some eligibilities that'll help me. But I think I'd probably take Jordan Walker over Spencer Steer, who's he's going to play, but he's not as exciting. Yeah. So I moved him up a little bit in my headpiece, but I don't know if I'm going to make him a target. I'd rather, you know what I'd rather do at third base? Stay out of that part.
Not get into this problem in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I agree. But hey, there's only so many third basemen to go around. Things break a certain way, and you got to have some backup plans in place. The last of the interesting prospects, I think, is Brett Beatty, at least for the early part of 2023. I really like what he did last season in the minors. I look at this depth chart. He's a third baseman who reasonably could take time away from Eduardo Escobar, or he could end up in left field a little bit. I think that's a little harder to see just because they just added Tommy Pham. So they have Mark Canha and Tommy Pham reunited with Nimmo. They got Marte. Outfield's a little more crowded. But his natural position at third base and even DH. Like, yeah, we're a pro Daniel Vogelbach podcast, but this is kind of like the Yepez thing where it's like, Daniel Vogelbach is a guy that goes around on waivers, gets sent around in minor trades, and is fine until you have someone better. And Brett Beatty might be that someone better. So do you have any optimism here?
There's also the question of where to play Eduardo Escobar. Eduardo Escobar had -6 outs above average. That's 224 out of 268 last year in outs above average. Even his Fangraphs defensive stats were the worst of his career. He seems to be moving off of the position, off of the defensive position. He could be an interesting situation to have a DH as a switch hitter. Also, just think about it this way: not necessarily your DH, but plays more DH and is de-emphasized on the defensive depth chart. In other words, also his projection is for basically league average with the bat. Beatty's with Steamer, obviously Steamer is aggressive, but it's 120 WRC plus. He's easily the best bat. He's not that much of a slouch defensively. I think, you know, if he doesn't break camp with the big league team because they want Guillorme and Escobar on this team, and they have now a bunch of outfielders and they want Vogelbach, I could see Beatty not breaking camp. But one injury and he might Wally Pip somebody. He could easily push Escobar. In fact, by projections, he's the better player than Escobar right now. So push Escobar into a timeshare DH situation, whatever it is. Beatty's exciting. And I think the team has a need for him. I don't know why I'm a little bit more excited about Beatty than Walker. I mean, he makes a lot more contact. They're both quality teams with deep depth charts that don't need to break camp with this player. I would say that the Mets have more of a need at third than the Cardinals have in the outfield.
I think that's fair. It's not a massive difference, but the couple things I really liked about Beatty from a season ago is that he lifted the ball a lot more often. If you look back at some of the numbers we'd seen at high A, 51.6% ground ball rate, not quite what you're looking for a guy with that big-time power. He got that down to 42.6%, so we saw that improvement.
But it came back.
Came back during his little time at AAA and his brief time in the big leagues. I still think he's figuring it out.
I asked him about that. I asked him about that at the Futures game, and he said, I'm just trying to hit the ball hard. And that's a viable solution. I mean, you know the Rays would love this guy. 113 max EV, 50% ground ball rate. Tampa, call up Tampa and get whatever you want for him.
Yeah, lifting the pulled balls, though. I think that's something we could see a little more of from Brett Beatty. If I take one shot between the two, it's Walker over Beatty. He does go earlier, but I think you're right to point out the flaws of Eduardo Escobar, because that, paired with Vogelbach being the primary DH, it's not a combo to overcome. The roster gets a little funky, though. If you have Vogelbach and Ruff and Escobar and none of those guys are good at playing defense, that doesn't really work either. Like, that's probably one too many guys that don't play defensively.
I think Ruff is the guy who loses his job if Beatty pushes Escobar off of third. Because you've got Tommy Pham and Mark Canha, who are not amazing defensively, although Canha's all right. And, you know, Pham's actually pretty poor, but Pham's a righty. Right? Yeah, Pham's a righty. So Pham could easily become
your outfielder slash righty DH. If you even if you keep Vogelbach, whereas Ruff, I don't know, it's really rough.
it is.
I don't really want him playing in the outfield, you know, if he can't, if he's not going to hit lefties, then he's going to be in trouble.
Few other guys getting prolonged opportunities, at least potentially. How about Jamer Candelario going to the Nationals?
There's a boring old guy that has a ton of opportunity and could be way better, and he's playing better in the Dominican Winter Leagues too.
And he's not even that old. I mean, he's old-ish. He's 29. But getting out of Comerica, going into Nationals Park, there's a nice little park factors boost.
Yeah, and really, you know, his barrel rate was in his max EV was right where it was. He just chased too much last year. It was the highest chase rate of his career by a lot. And I think that affected his batted ball quality because he, you know, maybe making contact on pitches outside of the zone. It led to one of the highest swing strike rates of his career. So I think, you know, if they can find a way to have him chill out, and that's a little bit tough with also putting him and being like, this is one of your last great chances of your career, but chill out. Don't chase anything. but you know, having an everyday thing, maybe he doesn't have a good first couple of weeks, but then he realizes, man, they're going to give me all season. Then I think he can chill out and get to 240, 15, 17 homers. I mean, that's when you're that's where you're shopping, and that's fine.
About J.D. Davis, you know, we thought this was interesting when the Mets and Giants hooked up on that trade, the one that sent Darren Ruff to the Mets in July or August. Davis has had good underlying numbers in the past, has shown at times an ability to keep the K rate down. It's just like, has he ever had the full run with near everyday playing time where all the skills have showed up at once? And is there any reason to believe that that could happen in San Francisco?
I mean, the closest time that it did get to happening was in San Francisco. You know what I mean? Like, was this the late season? You got 158 plate appearances in 2 months with San Francisco, right? Like, what does that average out to?
It's about 500. Yeah, but the K rate was up. That's the only, like, if you're picking, it's like the K rate didn't come down. 35.4% K rate.
Chase barreled a ton. I think he was just trying to show him he could be an everyday player, you know. It didn't come with a 4% walk rate or anything. So you know, he was 42% better than league average with the Giants. The one thing that I thought was really interesting was watching him prepare at third base a lot, knowing that this team has pushed the envelope a little defensively on players sometimes. I know that the reputation is that J.D. Davis has bricks for hands, but I thought he looked fine at third base. And if he looks fine at third base, Wilmer Flores is getting old. He's a right-hander that's, you know, a little bit better cast as hitting against lefties. David Villar did not hit fastballs at all last year, and had a pretty bad strikeout rate. So you're asking him to do a lot of damage on breaking balls, you know, for him to be even league average, I think. So I think there's opportunity for J.D. Davis at two positions is the long wind, the short of it. I think there's opportunity at first where Lamont Wade Jr., you know, hits a lot of fly balls and sometimes gets into that really low batting average, you know, all or nothing territory. And, you know, he could at least be a platoon partner there. And then I think there's opportunity at third base.
Yeah, I think it's going to work out, at least in terms of getting him closer to that one very good season. The closest thing we saw, it was almost a full season. It was 140 games, only 453 plate appearances. Back in 2019, when Davis had that 21.4% K rate, popped the 22 homers. Of course, that was the year of the rabbit ball. But everything happened at once. And I think that was sort of like optimal usage, like small side platoon, but then more playing time on top of that. That's basically what they did with Davis that year. So maybe without the average, we could see something similar for him in San Francisco. And he's late.
I still think he's like what, like NL only reserve pick? And
yeah, it's kind of like the, I think it was the Brandon Belt cluster at the end where it's like you can't really take him in a mixed league with moves to start the year, but you kind of have to watch and be quick to jump early on. If the playing time is at the higher end of expectations, you could pick him up, but I don't know if you necessarily want to draft him with one of your last picks in a 15
draft
team
and hold. And like, what about draft and hold? I guess it'd be okay as like a third or fourth, you know, like a fourth guy.
Depth corner in a draft and hold, totally fine for NL only. Because he'll probably actually play. Really like him for NL only. Yeah,
he'll probably play. Yeah, I love him as an NL only reserve pick if he lasts that far. Even as a dollar guy, I think I'd be all right with him.
Yeah, I think he's great in that spot. I think, you know, DJ LeMahieu, I guess, fits more into this conversation. He should have gone a little earlier in the conversation, kind of up where Moncada goes. The reason I want to fold him into the late darts conversation,
because his projections are awful.
Yeah, his ADP has him like still playing every day. His projections don't. I kind of think he's going to play every day because we were looking at this depth chart. He's the main third baseman. It depends on how much they want to sit Josh Donaldson. So there's kind of a few questions wrapped in here. How much does Donaldson sit? How often is Donaldson hurt? How often is Anthony Rizzo hurt? And how often is Giancarlo Stanton hurt?
And how often does Giancarlo Stanton play the outfield?
And then that's the other thing. Could they put Stanton in left field, right? If they don't like what they're getting from Hicks, Cabrera, some of the options they have out there, if they want to put Stanton in the outfield, then they've got the DH spot open. So Donaldson and LeMahieu and Rizzo could all be in the lineup together between first and third and DH. So I guess where are you at on playing time for LeMahieu and Josh Donaldson? Donaldson's in the dusty corner of the closet where you need to run the vacuum, and LeMahieu still just barely inside the top 300 because he's got first, second, and third base eligibility and pretty safe skills.
I actually think the sharper your league is, the better LeMahieu becomes as a pick. Because the sharper your league is, the more likely they're hewing close to their projection system. You know? Of course, the very sharpest of projection systems and leagues will have their own custom playing time number, right? But if they're just pulling from Fangraphs, and getting this 400 plate appearance number, they're not going to draft him. He's just not going to go at that ADP. So I don't really like him at ADP, but I love him if he starts to drop because we're all looking at the same projection system.
Yeah, DJ LeMahieu has had over 500 plate appearances every year since 2014, with 2020 being an exception. He was pacing out to be an everyday guy that year. So, yeah. You know, that's the playing time is there. And he is under contract through 2026. I don't think you look at a guy who's under contract for four more years
and you just make him a bench
guy. You're a $15 million backup now. Yeah. I know the Yankees are near top end in payroll and can do something like that.
And Donaldson is so close to being done. I know that the defensive numbers are still good, and they're part of what keeps him on the field. And he did still manage to be around league average and hit 15 homers, but it didn't look good. And they seem to not want to play him, and the fans don't like him. And even the projections are for like just barely above league average. I could see if he comes out next year and is playing similarly that he did last year, they could just make the switch. I mean, it's the last year of Donaldson's contract. And LeMahieu could be a better player. I mean, just on OBP, Donaldson's projected for 318 to 320, and LeMahieu's projected for 340 to 350. And I know that's not everything. There's power too, but like, you know, what does this team need more? Somebody to get on base or someone to hit for homers? And I kind of think they might need someone to get on base more.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm on the LeMahieu side of this one. If you have to choose between the two for who actually ends up with more playing time, factoring in health and how the pieces fit, all those other factors that we're talking about. You mentioned Spencer Steer, I think, at the end of the first base preview. He's third base eligible in a lot of leagues, so just a heads up that if you are looking for some late darts, he could be pretty interesting with a nice path.
You know, they do have Ellie De La Cruz coming up, but he's going to play shortstop when he comes up because the opposition is Kevin Newman and Jose Barrero, who haven't shown anything. They do have, who's the other guy they got? Noel V. Marte.
Yep, and they got Christian Encarnacion Strand coming too.
But Noel V. Marte didn't even hit AA last year. So I don't think that Noel V. Marte is necessarily a candidate to come up with that much this year.
No, he's more of an end-of-year call-up. you know, kind of similar to Henderson and Carroll from last season, if it happens, and otherwise an early 2024 ETA.
Strand did hit double A, but it was a step back for him in Cincinnati. So I do think that they're going to send him back to double A to see what they've got. And then with Steer, one thing I didn't like when they brought him up was they played him all over. So I do kind of think that maybe he's headed towards utility. But I think to start the year, they will play him. What's interesting, Votto will be out to start the year, won't he?
Yeah, I haven't looked at his timetable recently.
So who's going to play first? Myers? They get more of a look at Fairchild and Friedel and Fraley in the outfield? Yeah, probably.
Torn left rotator cuff. Yeah, that's a pretty big injury. That's a it's going to be a close one, I think, for Votto.
Yeah, I think he might miss the beginning of the season. But then Steer could also be included in the first base mix. But I think he's got a large runway. I think he's at least got a month to start the season where he'll get near everyday playing time. And there's stuff to like about his abilities. If not to put him necessarily in the top echelon of prospects or anything. He's 25 and his glove hasn't looked amazing in any one position.
So I think that pretty much covers it. Third base, have a plan. Try to go early. If you can't go early, don't wait too long in the middle. At least seek out the player you want, especially the kind that fits your build, right? If you can afford the batting average hit, there's a few guys that mash, Chapman, Suarez among them. If you really need a more balanced player, maybe a speed-first player, like Brian Hayes works. If you need something kind of in between, maybe it's Ryan McMahon. There are a handful of prospects like the same thing we said at the end of the first base episode. If you're going prospect at third base, you're going to need a veteran, oatmeal-y, or multiple eligible position player to actually cover that spot to make sure that you have enough playing time. But this is a bit of a funky time at third base. I don't remember it being quite like this years ago. I think last year was a little similar to this year. This year seems a tad worse overall.
But Brian Anderson and Isaac Paredes, along with a prospect, I like that idea.
Yeah, you can find it. There's a few guys real late that will play enough to keep things afloat even in deeper leagues. As we go, a reminder, you can get a subscription to The Athletic for just $2 a month for the first year at theathletic.com/ratesandbarrels. You can email us at ratesandbarrels@theathletic.com. On Twitter, Eno is at EnoSaris. I am at Derek Van Riper. The position preview series rolls on. Come back soon.
Thanks for listening.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.